And of course, the whole antitrust apparatus is based on a lot of mythology. And maybe the first one I'll start with is predatory pricing, since I put an old article of mine on the reading list. And you know, I'll tell you the story of predatory pricing. And it's been a theory that's been around for a long time of the supposed creation of free market monopoly. And the basic theory is that a firm with that is said to have a large war chest of profits from somewhere will use those profits to subsidize losing money on purpose by pricing below cost for an uncertain amount of time, with the idea of driving all the competition out of the market with its low prices. And then once the other firms are driven out of the market, then it will establish a monopoly and will charge a monopolistic price. And that's how monopoly is created. There's a lot of folklore about John D. Rockefeller having established monopoly power in the 19th century and early 20th century about that. But of course, Rockefeller never was a monopoly, even when the government broke his company up in the year 1911. That is a Standard Oil Company. He still had over 300 competitors, including big companies like Sunoco. They were in the market in America, not to mention the Russians and other Europeans who were in the oil business at the same time. And so he had international competition to contend with, in addition to domestic competition. But the theory of predatory pricing still is popular among lawyers. Of course, any theory that allows them an excuse to sue somebody is popular with them. It was largely discredited by the economics profession, by Austrians and Chicago School economists quite a few years ago. And then it was resurrected by game theorists who, of course, with game theory, you can concoct any kind of story that you want based on the assumptions that you make. So you could always weave some sort of tall tale about how under certain circumstances, in theory, predatory pricing would work. Although in the real world, I'll explain why it never does. And there are a number of good reasons why. I guess the first economist to really take a really close look at this was an economist named John McGee, who published an article in the Journal of Law and Economics. I think it was in 1958, way back when. It was a long case study of the Standard Oil Company antitrust case, the government's antitrust case against John D. Rockefeller's Standard Oil Company. And he went through there, and one of the things he found was that Rockefeller, under no circumstances practiced predatory pricing, because it would have been very foolish for him to do so. And regardless of anything else anyone ever said about John D. Rockefeller, who became the richest man in the world during his day, he was nobody's fool. And McGee established a very systematic way of thinking about predatory pricing and the likelihood of establishing a monopoly through predatory pricing. And a real classic benefit-cost analysis, you know, is it worth it to try to do this? And he established the following principles. If you look at the downside or the risks to a business of trying to establish a monopoly on the free market by predatory pricing, well, the assumption, first of all, is that the dominant firm or the largest firm in the industry will be doing this, will be pricing below cost to drive everyone else out. Well, that means point number one is that the largest firm will also be the largest loser. If it has the largest volume of sales and it's losing money on purpose on every sale, it's losing more money than anybody else. So that's point number one that leads to a downside of this tactic. Point number two is there's a uncertainty about how long this would last. How long do you have to price below cost to drive everyone out? 1 year, 2 years, 10 years, 30 years? That certainly is a vital piece of information because if it's a long period of time, it's totally futile to do this. A third point about this is that the competitors are not just going to sit back and allow you to drive them out of the market if this is what you're doing. They could always temporarily shut down and say, well, let him lose the money. Let him price below cost if he wants, and they'll temporarily shut down. And then when you're finished losing money and you're charging above cost again, well, then they can reopen. So that's one strategy that competitors can use to fight this. There's also the risk that if a company starts what is sometimes called a price war, predatory pricing is sometimes called a price war, it could spread to different markets. You know, if you're selling in different markets, Chicago, St. Louis, New York, the same thing could spread. So you might have started this, the potential predatory pricer in one market, one city, not intending to do it elsewhere, but you may not have control over that. The competitors may react to it. Another point is that there's a logical inconsistency in the theory in that it assumes that there's a war chest of monopoly profits, but the predatory pricing strategy is said to be the strategy that is used to create the monopoly profits. So it is just assumed out of thin air that monopoly profits exist, and there's no explanation of where these monopoly profits or this war chest came from. It's just, a magic act creates a war chest of profits that the predatory pricer can dip into to finance this practice of losing money on purpose. Another important point here is that when you look at these downside risks, you're the largest loser, there's great uncertainty about how long this can go on, it can spread to different markets, and where's the war chest coming from, how big is the war chest? Any business would have to weigh this against the opportunity cost. That is, that this the theory is that the firm is investing money in establishing a monopoly. If you're losing money on purpose, well, that's what an investment is. You're not losing money, but you're foregoing consumption now in order to invest or you're going to debt now in order to invest in something that you hope will create higher levels of income or profits in the future. But the opportunity cost is there are a lot of other ways to make money. You can just put it in low risk government bonds. You can invest in the stock market. Even lobbying for a monopoly franchise is an alternative means of trying to create monopolistic profits compared to predatory pricing. So when you consider the huge risks of this, and then weigh it against the opportunity cost, it seems like an extraordinarily risky investment. And as is true of all such theories, including all the oligopoly theories, the entry ruins it all. If at some point you do pull this off and you drive everyone out of the market with your low prices, there's nothing to stop entry from occurring from anywhere in the world. And so here you are losing money for years. And then once you think you're in the catbird seat, as so-called, and you're at your monopoly, entry floods in from all over the world because you're charging super high prices, monopolistic prices. And so that's certainly something to worry about too. And it all makes it very unlikely that this could be a strategy that would work. Another thing is, consumers, customers, they can stock up on whatever it is you're selling, depending on what the product is. They can stock up on this during the low price period. If you're charging below cost, they can stock up and they can even compete with you. They can be playing arbitrage here, as can your competitors. Your competitors can be buying your product, which you are selling on the market at below cost, and then when you're finished doing that, they have a big stockpile of your products that that cost them less than it costs you to produce, and they can put them on the market and make a handy profit. So both customers and your competitors can take advantage of this and compete with you in that way. One final comment about this is that even if a predatory pricer does succeed in eliminating everybody else from the market, and causing bankruptcy. Well, what happens with bankruptcy? These firms, the assets of these firms don't just disappear. They're not blown up or pushed into the ocean. In most cases, most or all of the assets are purchased by another firm. And so if bankruptcy does occur of all the competitors, new competitors will arise who will purchase some or all of the assets of the bankrupted firms. So you'll have competition from those companies. And so so if you take all these considerations into account, these are all reasons why just on a theoretical basis, it just doesn't make sense. I once taught an MBA class when and a lot of the MBA students, managerial economics class, believed in this. They hadn't really seriously studied economics before. And so they sort of thought, well, yeah, this is how monopolies are established. And I have people in this class that were in Baltimore, where my university is, who were executives at Black & Decker, the tool-making company. And I asked them, well, what do you suppose your boss would say if you went back to work on Monday? This was a Saturday morning class. Go back to work on Monday and tell him, here's what I learned in the MBA class that you are paying for, you Black & Decker is paying for. We should get this drill that we manufacture, and our marginal cost is $50. Let's sell it for $10 and drive everyone from the market out there. It might take 2 years, 5 years, maybe even 10 years, but we'll drive every tool maker out of the market in this way. And then I can guarantee you that no entry will occur when we start charging $500 for the drill. They all uniformly thought it was silly, crazy. A few said, I'd probably get fired if I said such a stupid thing. So if you just think about it for a few minutes systematically, it makes no sense at all. And that's why in the article that I put on the reading list, it's old, I think it was a 1992 or something like that, or maybe an earlier article that I wrote on it called The Myth of Predatory Pricing. There was an article that I cited there of someone who did a survey up to that point of all the federal antitrust cases that had been prosecuted in the area of predatory pricing. And they did not find in all history a single example of anyone who had established an actual monopoly, which is a single seller. That's the definition of the textbook definition of mainstream economics of a monopoly. And so it has never established a monopoly anywhere in reality. And so after all of this, this was all pretty well established by the economics profession. Austrians wrote about it, and Chicago School economists like John McGee, who was a Chicago School economist, wrote about it. As I said, the mathematicians in the economics profession, who are overwhelmingly statists and interventionists, began tinkering with game theory, and now they claim that using game theory, you can create the plausible scenarios where this could work, although they still haven't created an actual example of it, which is why I call predatory pricing the unicorn of economic theory. People may talk about it. There are rumors of sightings, but no one has ever actually got a picture of one. I mean, a real one and seen one. It doesn't exist. There's an international version of the theory of predatory pricing. It goes by the name of dumping. And sort of a definition of dumping is a business that charges a lower price in a foreign country for the same product than it does in its own country. So if Toyota sells Toyota Camrys at a dollar less in America than it does in Tokyo, that's the definition of dumping. The way the U.S. government handles this, though, is not according to that definition. The U.S. government has a very long, complicated formula that they use to determine what the right price is that should be charged in the U.S. And so it's not the actual price. It's not a matter of just saying, well, what are they charging in the United States? The government creates a bogus price based on some incredibly complicated formula that would fill up an entire classroom blackboard. And if a foreign manufacturer charges lower than that price, that the government thinks is the right price, not the free market price in America, but this imaginary price that the government sets, then they can be accused of dumping, which is predatory pricing in an international market. And the penalties in the U.S. for dumping are, the firm has to give up a lot of proprietary information to the U.S. government. If it does not do that, then as much as 100% tariff can be imposed on its products coming in the United States. And of course, these companies are not going to give up proprietary information on their products in business practices. And so the dumping laws in the United States, based on this bogus theory of predatory pricing, are an excuse to put as high as 100% tariff rate on foreign products coming into the United States. And of course, the government did this in the 1980s on minivans, when minivans were first became popular in the U.S. The American automakers took over the market. The Japanese automakers were slow to realize that this was a product that could sell in the U.S. market. But then, you know, pretty soon Toyota and Nissan and Mitsubishi, the rest, caught up and they started competing. And in order to compete, you know, at a time when they had a very, very small market share, less than 10%, they started charging pretty good prices, low prices, lower than what they were selling these vehicles for in Japan. And but it was something like less than 1% lower. And the Reagan administration in the 1980s brought dumping charges against the Japanese minivan sellers and threatened to put big tariffs on Japanese minivans. So that's how it works. And it's also, there are also a lot of antitrust lawsuits that use predatory pricing. In the 1970s, when AT&T finally began experiencing competition, it was forced to compete in long-distance phone service, it claims to have spent about $100 million a year in legal fees defending against predatory pricing cases. Just predatory pricing cases, not other types of antitrust cases. $100 million a year. And so it was routine in that business, apparently, that if anybody is competing by cutting price, you sue them for predatory pricing. And so that's how this idea has actually hindered competition, because it sues companies for doing what competition is supposed to do, push down prices. Okay, and so I guess that's about all what I wanted to say about this for now, about predatory pricing as a myth, one of the myths of free market monopoly. And it's sort of a part of the folklore. A second thing I would mention that's much more recent is the QWERTY myth, Q-W-E-R-T-Y, the letters on your keyboard, on your laptop keyboard, computer keyboard. If you were to Google two names, Stan Liebowitz and Steve Margolis and QWERTY, Q-W-E-R-T-Y, you'll find some very good articles by Liebowitz and Margolis on QWERTY. And the story here is that probably about 20 or 25 years ago, there was an economist named Paul David, who was a Keynesian and a big interventionist and a statist economist who once wrote, for example, that the long gasoline lines that existed in the United States in the 1970s because of price controls on gas were ended when state governments adopted even odd license plate regulation, where you could only buy gasoline on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday if your license plate ended in an even number, and then Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday if it ended in an odd number. He thought that's what ended the shortages and not the elimination of price controls. So this is the kind of economist, quote, economist Paul David is. But he published an article that was widely cited by other interventionist economists claiming that QWERTY, the invention of the keyboard with this configuration of letters, created what is called path dependence, where the whole industry of typing and then eventually personal computers had locked in an inferior technology. And he claimed that was sort of a form of market failure in the marketplace, where sometimes technologies that are adopted for whatever reasons could be inferior. And of course, he advocates government intervention to regulate and control technology to avoid this sort of lock-in of inferior technology. But anyway, Liebowitz and Margolis looked into this in a lot more detail. And the evidence, so-called, that Paul David originally compiled was that there was an alternative keyboard that was called the Dvorak keyboard, spelled D-V-O-R-A-K. It's a Czech name He was an American. This Dvorak was an American of Czech origin, and he was a U.S. naval officer in World War II. And he developed an alternative keyboard, and it was Dvorak who claimed that his keyboard was superior to the QWERTY keyboard. And when Leibowitz and Margolis looked into it, they found out that the evidence to back up this claim, which Paul David cited, was some studies done by, guess who, Dvorak himself, when he was in the Navy, and he just got a couple of secretaries who worked for him to do some typing on the QWERTY keyboard and the Dvorak keyboard, and then he claimed that his was superior. So, first of all, that's kind of like Coca-Cola claiming to have done some taste testing of cola drinks and concluding with scientific precision that Coca-Cola is superior to Pepsi-Cola. And so, just on that score, it's suspect, these so-called studies. But then, eventually, Leibowitz and Margolis and others did other studies also, typing studies, and found out that there was no real significant difference between the two keyboards. Consumers just chose the QWERTY keyboard. And of course, in a market economy, the consumer is king. You can argue for the rest of your life that the particular technology that you and your company are developing is superior to some other technology that is more successful in the marketplace. But in a market economy, that doesn't count. What counts is what consumers have chosen. You can always try to persuade the consumers, but if you fail, what are you going to do? Get the government to force them to make decisions they don't want? That's what a lot of people would choose to do. And so the QWERTY turned out to be a big myth, although it was very popular for a long time in claiming that the free market locked in all this inferior technology out there. There were other examples back in the days of VHS machines, where people watched videos on VHS machines. There were two video recorders. There were two types, VHS and Beta, were the two technologies. And there were a slew of articles claiming that Beta was superior, even though VHS won the competitive battle. And that turned out to be false also in terms of the technology. Once people studied the technologies, they found out that consumers are not as dumb as the economists think. They did choose the superior technology. Now, an alternative way of looking at this is something I've been working on recently in a paper of mine, is that there is such a thing as locking in inferior technology, but the examples, it seems to me, are legion. They're everywhere of lock-in of inferior technology by government. It's government that locks in inferior technologies. Look at the technology of public education in America, especially, where you basically use the same, much of the same technology that was used 100 years ago in public education. A historical example that I've written about is in American history, in the early 19th century, a canal was dug between Lake Erie and the Hudson River, the Erie Canal. And so farmers from the American Midwest would bring their agricultural products across Lake Erie and into the Erie Canal and transport them to the East Coast through this canal. And the canal worked. The canal was dug by tens of thousands of men. Several thousand of them died of swamp fever during the digging of the canal, by the way. And barges hauled the produce, dragged by mules all across the state. Now, this was all, and this was subsidized by the government of New York. And this was almost at the exact same time that the railroad industry was developed. And including the railroad industry in New York State. And so you have the railroad industry, which is obviously a superior technology for transporting agricultural products compared to dragging barges through a canal with mules. But the Erie Canal lasted, it made money for decades and decades, well into the 20th century, because of the subsidies. that it got originally from the government. But in terms of locking in an inferior technology into the 20th century with the development of railroads, to have mules dragging barges at 2 miles an hour across the entire state of New York, that's a pretty good example of locking in an inferior technology, I would argue. Another more recent example, in the United States, a lot of you know that the air traffic controllers have been in the news lately because quite a few of them seem to be falling asleep on the job, and airplanes have been landing without the benefit of air traffic control. Well, it was only about 10 or 12 years ago that the American Air Traffic Control System, which is run by the government, did away with vacuum tubes as a way of its communication. Now, vacuum tubes used to be in televisions, but with the invention of computer chips and computers, we did away with all the vacuum tubes technology, but not the government air traffic controllers. Just a few years ago, really, they were still using vacuum tubes. And so this is an ancient technology, grossly outdated. It was outdated by 1980, everywhere in the world. And they still used it for another 20 years almost in the government air traffic control system. And so, what you have is whenever the government adopts a technology and puts it into place, one thing that happens is that particular technology gathers around it special interest groups or pressure groups who all benefit or profit from selling and managing that technology. So you create a political cabal around that will see to it that technology stays in place for a long time because they profit by it. And whereas on the free market, you don't have that. You don't have the coercive force of government locking in inferior technologies. If a superior technology comes about, that's where the profit is, to come to use the superior technology. But in politics, the profit to some people is in locking in the inferior, the old technology, and they may succeed for decades in keeping that old technology there, as far as that goes. In England, for example, after the invention of refrigeration, the British government subsidized for many, many years milkmen with horses and wagons delivered milk door to door. That was an inferior technology for the delivery of milk in the age of refrigeration. But because of the milkman lobby, I guess, in Great Britain, resources were devoted to this old, outdated technology for many years. That doesn't happen on the free market. It would be ridiculous to think of that happening in the free market at the expense of any business person. Okay, but this is a whole big area open for research as far as I'm concerned, because there's been all this literature debating whether lock-in is a problem in the free market, when I think it's just hitting you in the face that inferior technology is locked in everywhere with government programs. And so I may well end up writing a whole book about this. And that's all I'm going to say about that, the QWERTY myth and lock-in of technology. Let's see, what should I pick up next? The next thing I'll mention is price fixing. Let's take the toughest case against the free market, in that there are price fixing conspiracies that can create monopolistic prices, cartels. This is essentially the cartel theory. And it's very popular. Businesses do try to collude. They do talk about pricing. That doesn't mean they succeed, but that happens. But what are the things that you should think about that would lead you to be skeptical of the creation of a monopoly in the free market, even through price fixing conspiracies? One thing is the existence of substitutes for any good. Any product or service that's being sold and is there's a price fixing conspiracy to establish a monopoly price, especially in the age of globalization, as it's called, there's substitutes and potential substitutes. The mere fact that if you do succeed in a price fixing conspiracy and pushing up the price to monopolistic levels, That creates an incentive to quickly come up with substitutes, close substitutes for that good. And once that happens, the demand for your good becomes much more elastic, and the cartel breaks down. There's also international competition. You know, with globalization, these substitutes can come from anywhere. That's not just domestically. And then, of course, there's the cost of policing any such agreement. There's no honor among thieves, as the saying goes. Another aspect of this is that if you hit a recession, if you consider the business cycle, businesses that are propping up prices, if consumer demand goes way down as it does during a recession, you're not going to succeed in propping prices way up. An example, a ridiculous example is I had somebody in my yard do some tree work, trimming and cutting down a tree that had died in my yard, and he charged something like $100 for the work. The next year, I had some more work, and for a similar amount of work, he wanted $2,000. And I asked this man, well, what is going on here, $100 versus $2,000? And this was right after the real estate bubble burst, and we entered this recession or depression that we're in. And this tree service guy tells me, my business is way off. I need to raise my prices to make up for the lost revenue. And of course, that is very stupid business practice. But that's what we're talking about with price fixing. If you were price fixing in a recession, it's not going to work. People aren't going to pay the price because demand is lower than it was when you weren't price fixing. And so over the business cycle, it's not going to work. And of course, when conspirators, cartel conspirators, if they get together and try to prop up prices by reducing production, as the Arab OPEC oil cartel did, years ago when it was successful. Well, one of the things you sacrifice is economies of scale, because if economies of scale, which is declining long-run average cost over time as you increase output, as firms agree to reduce output or reduce production in order to prop up prices, they sacrifice the benefits of economies of scale and their costs go up. And so if the costs go up, of course, that squeezes the profit margins somewhat. And so all of these things interfere with the success of price-fixing conspiracies. And on top of that, there's always entry. You know, even if you do pull it off, entry will break it up. And of course, there's the classic cheating problem. This is why cartels always break up, and this is why businesses often resort to government to try to get government to enforce the cartels, because they never work in private, as far as that goes. And two final comments is Adam Smith, in his famous book, The Wealth of Nations, addressed the issue where one of the famous passages that I can paraphrase, where Adam Smith said, businessmen seldom meet, even in merriment, where the conversation does not turn into some sort of conspiracy against the public. He was talking about price-fixing conspiracies. Whenever businessmen meet, even over a beer, in merriment. But then the very next sentence in The Wealth of Nations says that it would be inconsistent with liberty and justice for the government to do anything about this, because Adam Smith understood that these business people who are selling their products, they're selling their own private property. And if it's private property, they are free to ask whatever price they want to ask for their private property. And you as a consumer are also perfectly free to say no thanks. And so Adam Smith recognized the property rights angle of this. And this is the type of thing that Murray Rothbard would have pointed out with regard to this whole issue as well. Any kind of law that interferes with price fixing is an interference in property rights, as far as that's concerned. And the final point I'll make is a more of an economic point than a philosophical one, is that you can think of benefits of price fixing in that some industries that have very heavy fixed costs, like pharmaceuticals or the airline industry, the companies might not exist without the extra profits that they earn if they were successful in price fixing. or they might go out of business during the business cycle, the downturn of the business cycle. So you can make a case that there are economic benefits to periodic price fixing that props up prices as far as this goes. And in the pharmaceutical industry case, if they plow more of those profits into research and development, then the consumers get more drugs and cheaper drugs in the future. In the airline industry, you get more competition and lower prices because it costs a lot of money to buy airplanes, and so heavy fixed costs. And so, so even the most severe argument against the free market in terms of monopoly price fixing has a lot of flaws, has a lot of questions to it, as far as that goes. Which is why the old economists from Adam Smith on understood that monopoly really means a government grant of monopoly. A few other things I'll talk about. Price discrimination. There are, in the U.S. and a lot of other countries, there are laws against price discrimination. In the U.S., this is Section 2 of the Clayton Antitrust Act outlaws price discrimination. And it's mostly what economists call third-degree price discrimination, charging different prices to different customer groups based on different elasticities of demand. Classic example would be charging a higher price to business travelers on airplanes who make a reservation in 1 or 2 days in advance versus a lower price for leisure travelers who can book their vacation 3 months in advance. Price discrimination is what it's called. Now, in the law, there is something in the Clayton Antitrust Act. There's something called the good faith provision of the Clayton Antitrust Act. And what it says is that if a business is selling in two different markets, well, the markets are not necessarily geographic markets. It could be different types of customers. If the business is selling in two different markets, it is legal to cut your price in one market and therefore practice price discrimination, but only in good faith in response to a competitor who has already first cut his price. And that's what the good faith provision, so-called, of the Clayton Antitrust Act says. And so think about that. Now, you're selling in two different markets, say they're geographical markets, Washington, D.C. and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And it was illegal to charge different prices in the different markets under the Clayton Act, although businesses do it all the time. And they do it because the government doesn't have the resources to enforce this as much as it would like, thank goodness, from my perspective. But it is legal to charge different prices, say a lower price in the Pittsburgh market, if you have a competitor in the Pittsburgh market who has first dropped his price. Now, the problem that creates is the competitor can be found guilty of violating the antitrust law because he did not wait for you to go first and drop your price. How can he drop his price first? He's violating the Clayton Act if he produces or sells in two different markets or more, two or more different markets. And so the so-called good faith provision, literally, if it were enforced, would outlaw price cutting. And so there's a long history of economists writing about how that's the idea. The businesses who wanted this law put in place, they wanted a law that would outlaw price cutting. And this would do a good job of it if the government were to enforce this. And so what we come up with is that with the antitrust laws, if your price is held constant for a long period of time, you can be accused of a price-fixing conspiracy with your competitors. If your price goes up, you can be accused of monopolizing your industry. If your price goes down, you can be accused of predatory pricing or price discrimination. So no matter what happens to the price, if it stays the same, if it goes up, if it goes down, you can be sued for violating the antitrust laws. And I have read, in all my readings over the years, I've read of businesses that have been gone to court, been sued for all three. And over the course of a number of years, they raise their price. The government files an antitrust lawsuit for that. They keep their price stable for many years. They're in trouble again with the antitrust authorities. They start cutting their price. 5 years later, they get sued for predatory pricing. Walmart was sued for predatory pricing, has been sued several times for predatory pricing of pharmaceuticals. And of course, Walmart is famous for buying gigantic volumes of products and getting good discounts on volumes purchases, big volume purchases, and then passing on those big discounts to their customers. And so naturally, the higher priced drugstores, I call them mom and pop monopolies, didn't like that. And so in various states, they sued under the antitrust laws to keep Walmart from cutting its price, to the detriment of Walmart's customers. They really hated it when they started giving some things away for almost for free, some types of drugs at very, very low prices. Okay, so that's price discrimination. That's what I want to say for now about price discrimination. Let's see. One other topic, I guess, mergers and takeovers. We've talked about mergers and takeovers before, but I might mention something else about corporate takeovers. Is the language is very, very incendiary. A takeover, people who are engaging in corporate takeovers are raiders, corporate raiders. And you have the language of poison pills and things like this. And junk bonds or bonds that were used to finance corporate takeovers in the 1980s. Junk has a negative connotation. But as I mentioned before in the course, though, the classic article on this is by Henry Manny, M-A-N-N-E. It's called "Markets in the Corporations and the Market for Corporate Control," I think, is the title of the article. It was in the Journal of Political Economy way back in 1965. And the basic explanation of what corporate takeovers are about is that the so-called takeover raiders, which I prefer to call specialists, takeover specialists, think they have found a company that is not being managed as effectively as it can be and is therefore undervalued in the stock market. And based on their research, they believe that they can, if they can enter, say, a proxy battle and buy up shares, enough shares of stock to take control of the board of directors, they can fire the existing management, put different management in, and increase the profits of the company. And if they do that, since they have bought so many shares of stock, they will make huge amounts of money themselves as the stock price goes up. And of course, the customers would benefit because the company is run more efficiently and more competitive. The employees would benefit because there's more job security. And if the employees own stock, they benefit also. And the shareholders who sell out benefit. They would typically get a 20 to 40% premium in corporate buyouts. And so, who wouldn't want a one day 20 or 40% increase in the price of the stock that you own? That's a pretty good profit to be making for anybody. And so that's basically what corporate takeovers are about. It's called the market for managerial control. And so it's competition for managers. This is how managers are forced to compete. And now this market has been greatly watered down over the years. There are many state laws in the U.S. that make it much more difficult for this to happen. Michael Milken, who found ways to finance corporate takeovers with high-yield bonds, so-called junk bonds, went to prison for it. And so that certainly was a deterrent to other people to come up with the financing of billions of dollars sometimes to finance corporate takeovers. And so, and I think this has a lot to do with why today you read these stories of companies like here in Baltimore, Baltimore Gas and Electric, which is owned by Constellation Energy. The CEO, they lost $1 billion last year. And the CEO, though, his compensation went from $5 million last year to $20 million this year. So you read these stories of chief executive officers, their companies are losing billions, and yet they're getting a fourfold increase in their pay. Well, this sort of thing would not happen quite as often, I don't think, if the market for corporate control had not been so neutered by government regulation over the years and by the intimidation of sending people to prison for being involved in this market. And of course, the reason why these things happen is the powerful corporate executives whose jobs are threatened by corporate takeovers often spend a lot of their shareholders' money lobbying Congress and state legislatures to put these laws in place that thwart the market for corporate control. And so that's the point I would make about that for now. And so I have a few other things I was going to mention, but I see it's 8:16, and our routine has usually been to give about a 45 or 50 minute lecture, as you know, and then have Q&A. And so if there are Q&A questions from anybody, we'll do the same thing. I'd be glad to answer some questions. I see from Chris, he found the Henry Manny article. Very good. It's a really, really interesting topic, the market for corporate control. And there's a huge literature on it, but Manny was one of the very first to write about it. And so if you want to understand how it works and all the details of how the market for corporate control works, the Manny article explains it root and branch. And Henry Manny was one of the founders of the whole law and economics movement in America. He founded the Law and Economics Center at the University of Miami, and then he moved to the Emory University later, and then he ended his career at George Mason University Law School. So the whole law and economics movement in America, Henry Manny is one of the pioneers of the whole thing, and this article of his was an original classic in that field. So if you're interested in that, I would recommend it. But feel free to ask questions. I'll see if I'll sit here and look at the chat and see if there's any chatting going on. We usually do have some chat. How many documented cases of successful cartels in the U.S.? I don't think anybody has ever tried to document or even take a list of successful cartels in the U.S., but I do know we have a long history of attempts at cartels being formed, failing, and then running to the government and succeeding with the government. That's the history of the airline industry, the trucking industry, all the so-called public utilities, telephone service, electricity, natural gas. They all tried to form cartels in the 19th century, late 19th century, early 20th century, and the cartels all failed. And so they figured out a way to use the government to enforce the cartels through rape regulation. And I think I mentioned last week that when George Stigler won the Nobel Prize in Economics, one of the things he was cited for is his work on the theory of economic regulation. And he published several articles in academic journals. I'm pretty sure they were in places like the Bell Journal of Economics and Journal of Political Economy about how when rate regulation came into being, it actually caused the rates of electricity to go up, because these were companies that had been competitive, but they were created into cartels by the government. And then prices went up. That's what government-enforced cartels do. And so that's been the real problem with monopoly, is government-enforced cartels in all these industries, not private cartels. They never work. They break down for many of the reasons I gave tonight during the talk. Would any students with a microphone like to address the question by voice? Or audition for American Idol, either one. Guess not. Let's see, was Dvorak the only competing keyboard to QWERTY? Did QWERTY succeed after freely competing with other keyboards? As far as I know, maybe somebody else knows more about this. From the academic articles I've read, they seem to imply that there was only the Dvorak and QWERTY. And it's sort of like the Windows operating system. The consumers, most consumers just simply chose to use it for whatever reasons, even though Apple existed and there were other operating systems out there. So when Microsoft had 90% of the market for computer operating systems, it was because of primarily consumer choice. And I know a lot of people in the computer industry, a lot of my former students who were MBA students who were programmers and worked for software companies, hated Bill Gates and Microsoft with a passion because they were software engineers who were convinced that their product was far superior to Microsoft's. And they didn't like it very much when I told them that in a market economy, it's not their opinions as engineers that counts. It's the opinions of the consumer that counts in terms of, who gets the bigger market share and who doesn't. Let's see. Currently, the interest rates are very high. Kosovo, which led people to believe that the banks have formed a cartel. Is the case against cartels valid for the banking industry? Well, in the U.S., the banks were behind the creation of the Fed, the Federal Reserve Board, as really the cartel enforcer for the banks. And so if you read the classic explanation of this, is in several places, actually. Murray Rothbard's book, A History of Money and Banking in the United States, tells the whole story of the years leading up to the creation of the Fed, where it is a classic case of attempts by private cartels in the banking industry that failed year after year after year. And so they spent decades actually trying to get the government to enforce a cartel for banks so that they can lend more money than they had in reserve. Because with competition between the banks under a gold standard, if you lent excessive amounts of money beyond your reserves, you could go bankrupt. If people come and want to redeem their currency, for the gold or silver that is said to be behind the currency, and you don't have the gold and silver, you go bankrupt. And the banks lobbied for many, many years to have a government organization of some kind that would allow them to do that, to inflate the currency, and that was the Fed. And so Murray Rothbard writes about this there. I think also his book, What Has Government Done to Our Money, talks about it. It's much shorter. But if you want a real scholarly treatment that explains how in the U.S. the banks were cartelized by the government, a history of money and banking in the United States. Now, I don't know the Kosovo example, of course, but governments everywhere else in the world did seem to have done something similar. Once governments figure out some sort of scheme to benefit politically influential business groups at the expense of the public, and to recruit intellectuals to create a fog in the eyes of the public, and to convince the public that this monopoly scam is really in the best interest of the public. Once one government figures out how to do that, other politicians in all other countries will copy and imitate that. And that is certainly what they have done with central banking. In fact, we have a cartel of central banks in the world today. The Fed was sued a couple of years ago by Bloomberg News to tell them, Bloomberg News, who got the bailout money that the Fed printed up. And it was just a few weeks ago that finally the American legal system ruled in favor of Bloomberg News and forced the Federal Reserve Board to make public information about where these billions of dollars went in terms of bailouts, and much of it went to other central banks in other countries. And so it's one big gang of cartels who actually cartelize among themselves. They don't just operate a cartel for banks in their own countries, but they themselves are a cartel, operate as a cartel, because they're run by governments. The OPEC cartel is a cartel of governments. The government of Saudi Arabia and all these other countries that are members of OPEC, that's what it was. And so I suspect the Kosovo situation is similar to the U.S. Because, you know, one of the insidious things that happened after the collapse of communism is that the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the U.S. government, and others sent dozens or hundreds of academics and policymakers and bureaucrats to the former Soviet republics and Soviet satellites to advise them on how to set up antitrust laws like ours, banking systems like ours. And so they made sure that they set up all these rotten schemes that we have invented for government-run cartels over the years. And so they probably have the same problems that we do. Let's see, he's asking, what about the case, there is no monopoly central bank, so Kosovo doesn't have a central bank, which uses the euro non-officially. Does this resemble the free market more in terms of making it, I would think so. If there's no central bank, it represents a free market more, but I don't know the details about the Kosovo situation. You know, in the United States, we had all sorts of government intervention in banking without the Fed. There were laws that restricted branch banking. There were state governments that had all sorts of regulations on banking. The federal government from time to time would pass laws allowing banks to suspend specie payment, that is, to not back their currency with gold or silver. And so you don't need a central bank to have government regulation of banking. And so I can't answer the questions about Kosovo because I don't know the details, but that's where I would look. I would look at what kinds of interventions are there that are prohibiting a free market. And besides that, a free market doesn't guarantee low interest rates. One of the virtues of interest rates going up is, you know, interest rates can go up and down because of changing time preferences of the public. And one of the virtues of higher interest rates is that there's more of an incentive to save. And so if with more savings today, there can be more investment tomorrow. And with more investment tomorrow, there's faster productivity growth in the economy and therefore lower prices and a higher standard of living. And so high interest rates per se is not necessarily a bad thing, unless, of course, they're caused by hyperinflation by excessive monetary printing. But in the U.S., we had all sorts of government intervention for many generations without the Fed. You don't need a Fed to have government intervention. For example, we had the National Currency Acts in the 1860s that took a big step in the direction of nationalizing the money supply, but the Fed was not created until 1913. So we had all this intervention and federal control. But it took, 60 years or so in order to get the actual Federal Reserve Board in the U.S. The Mises Institute, I'm going to teach another course, which I taught last year on the beginning in June. What's the date? I think it begins the week of June 20th on The Road to Serfdom, the famous book by Friedrich Hayek. And I taught it last year after Glenn Beck mentioned The Road to Serfdom, and he had my old friend Yuri Maltsev on and Tom Woods on his show. And The Road to Serfdom, which was published in 1943, went to number one in sales on Amazon.com. And so I put together a 5-week course on The Road to Serfdom, and I'm going to teach it again this year, and we're going to use The Road to Serfdom. And I think I'm also going to incorporate some of a famous book by Ludwig von Mises entitled Omnipotent Government, because they're both books by Austrian economists that talk about the servitude of the state, serfdom, statism, omnipotent government. And it's an important part of the literature of Austrian economics. And so it'll be a 5-week course beginning, I think, the week of June 20th. This summer. And students last year, there were about 150 students or so who signed up from all over the world last year, because it really is a classic book. It's sort of like in the same category as Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand, who has a movie out now on Atlas Shrugged, but it went to number one in sales on Amazon about 2 or 3 years ago. And so these old classic books that have to do with liberty and economics are making a comeback. And so I'm going to, we'll have fun talking about that. Let's see. Monetary economics. Since you mentioned interest rates, the deposits in the banking sector are pretty high, but I guess the high political risk. Monetary economics, the view of a lot of the Austrians is that economics is economics, and that there really shouldn't be monetary economics and labor economics and the field of public finance. It should be all enveloped into one understanding of the economic system. And it was the sort of the mainstream of the economics profession who decided to departmentalize economics. But really, there's no reason why you can't talk about cartels and monopoly in the context of monetary economics. That's just sort of the way that academics in the 20th century tried to segment the markets and create little sort of monopoly niches for themselves by creating all these sub-disciplines. But the Austrians never really went that route. They believed that you should study economics, and the economics lessons you learn apply to all markets. And whether it's the market in the public finance, financial markets, or the Apple markets, good economics is good economics. Let's see. Austrian economists argue that investor protection programs are actually protectionist measures by government to help investment bankers. I wouldn't say all Austrian economists, because I know a lot of Austrian economists who don't know anything about this. And there is no official view of the Austrian economists. You can have individuals who call themselves Austrian who might express this particular view. But I'm not an expert on investor protection programs. I assume you're meaning government investor protection programs. But what I know about markets, though, and the study of such things is, I could actually quote Alan Greenspan favorably here. Back in his days when he was a protege of Ayn Rand, one of the things Greenspan wrote somewhere was a statement that, the way some of these government-run investor protection programs, like the Securities and Exchange Commission, for example, is supposed to protect investors from fraud and so forth. And Greenspan himself made the point maybe 50 years ago or 60 years ago that, okay, you can get your license from the Securities and Exchange Commission, and that tells everybody you are licensed, you have a government seal of approval, and then you can proceed to fleece your customers. On the other hand, in a free market, in order to persuade people to give you their hard-earned money to invest for them, you have to demonstrate with a record of good performance in the marketplace that you are trustworthy and that you know what you're doing and that you can earn money for them. And so a lot of times these government seals of approval or government protections are just phony. They don't work. They aren't necessarily monopoly scams by the investment bankers, but they create a false sense of security that people sometimes have. The Food and Drug Administration in the United States purports to regulate food quality and so forth, and most every other developed country has something like this, some sort of governed regulatory body that claims to assure us of food safety. But some years ago in France, the blood supply, which is regulated by the French government, was infected by the AIDS virus, by the HIV virus. And so government often fails, even though it brags about how it is protecting us from things. Government failure is quite prevalent. And so whenever I see something called a government investor protection program, it's sort of like you're going to shop around for investor protection. Do you really want something that is the quality of the Department of Motor Vehicles, or do you want some product or service that has been tried and true on the open market for 10, 20, or 30 years? I would pick the latter myself and be suspicious of any kind of government program that says it's going to protect me as an investor. After all, the government didn't do a very good job of protecting American investors when it allowed the real estate bubble, when it orchestrated the real estate bubble and the crash that caused trillions of dollars of losses in the stock market. And Chris will be there, the road to serfdom. He'll be on the road to serfdom and others. Chris Branco, insider trading. Well, again, Henry Manny is the man on insider trading. He wrote a book on insider trading. Maybe it's online, I don't know. But if you Google Henry Manny and insider trading, you'll at least find a reference to the book where he made the case that insider trading essentially provides information that would have been on the market anyway quicker, that it puts market information on the market quicker. And also, it is true that to this day, the U.S. government has no definition of insider trading. Even though they have put people in jail for insider trading, there is no definition by the government of insider trading. So it's very much in sync with all of antitrust law, where as businesses develop certain business practices that the government doesn't understand, the government could arbitrarily declare these business practices illegal whenever it feels like it. And it has done that with insider trading. But this, you know, in term, people used to criticize the free market by saying, well, yeah, the free market on the blackboard or in a textbook, it seems to work so fast. If demand shifts, there's a new equilibrium and then the market's clear. But in the real world, the markets work very slowly. It might take a long time for the markets to clear. In the meantime, there's all this instability. Okay, they made that criticism of the free market. And then the same people often make the same criticism that, well, yeah, insider trading does make this all work much faster, but that's a bad thing because it's unfair that some people have better information than other people. But of course, this is nothing more than saying that the International Division of Labor exists in the world, that, you know, we all specialize in something. We all have insider information about the particular job or task that we perform in our jobs, and I don't see any reason why people whose jobs are in the financial markets should be singled out as being making use of their information that they get on their jobs or in corporations any more than I use the inside information that I have on my job. You know, for example, when I taught the Road to Serfdom course, you know, what inside information did I have? Well, I had read the Road to Serfdom years ago. I knew the book inside and out. And so when I saw an opportunity to have a class in it with it being ranked number one in sales, I used my insider information, my knowledge of the Road to Serfdom and my understanding that there'd be a lot of people interested in it to put a course out there. And I profited from it. I made money. The Mises Institute made money on the course. And so that's insider information. And so we seem to be picking on people in the financial markets who use their specialized information that they've accumulated over their careers, or people in corporations, but not people in education or sports or anywhere else who also use different kinds of insider information and profit from it. And of course, the real insider information problem is political insider information, where politicians themselves know that this or that law that is about to be passed or this or that regulation is about to be passed is going to be a real market mover, and then they cash in a big way. And what typically happens is that the politicians will let some of their corporate supporters or some of their rich, wealthy supporters in on this information, and they will, you know, rake in millions of dollars from it. And then at some point, some of those millions will make their way back to the politicians. You know, for example, the politician will retire and will be given a $5 million a year job as a lobbyist for that corporation that it had been helping out all these years. And so, you know, you never hear of a member of Congress who retires who does not become a millionaire. You know, how did Bob Dole become a multimillionaire after being a public servant his entire life, for example? That's where the real insider trading problem is in America. It's the political insider trading. It's not in the free market. Insider trading just causes markets to work faster which the critics of markets used to say would be a virtue. But if you want to read a systematic treatment of insider trading, find Henry Manny's book. And there have been a few articles also in the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics over the years. I can't remember the exact issues, but if you're really interested in this, go online to the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics and just type, you know, in the search box, type in insider trading, and you'll find some articles. Other questions? I think we still need to wrap up pretty soon because there's another class. I think Danny needs to administer another course at 9 p.m. Eastern time. We might have time for one or two more questions if we have some. It looks like we're out of questions, I guess. Okay, well, thanks everybody for giving me the opportunity to do this course. This is one of my favorite topics, has been over the years, and I hope to see some of you on the road to serfdom. And I hope you learned a few things, and I hope you have a chance, if you haven't, to read the literature that I put on the syllabus. I think I spent a good bit of time picking out easy-to-read articles that provide you with a lot of information and a good bang for the buck in terms of your time. So I hope you liked it. And I'll make up an exam for anybody who wants to get a grade to go along with their certificate of completion from the Mises Institute. Okay, and have a great night. And thanks, Danny, for great help once again.